Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the program, with Donald Trump set to take the oath of office, we'll hear about Utahns who are attending and those who are protesting the inauguration. Also, Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes is rumored as an incoming, as a potential pick for to head the Federal Trade Commission. A poll shows the majority of Utahns want Representative Jason Chaffetz to investigate Trump's potential conflicts of interest. And Salt Lake City promises a report on the purchase of a shelter site in Sugar House. Those and various other stories on the docket today. And joining me for this discussion, Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry. Good morning, Dan.
Good morning.
Justice and safety reporter Jennifer Dobner is with us as well. Welcome, Jennifer. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
Reporter and web editor Matt Piper, thanks for being here, and good morning as well to you.
Good morning.
And last but not least, Salt Lake Tribune columnist, newly minted as a columnist, Robert Gerke. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning.
Newly inaugurated, maybe.
Yeah.
A reminder to our listeners that you are invited to participate in this Friday morning news wrap-up with your questions and comments at sltrib.com or by calling 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. We are now, I believe, less than an hour away from the swearing-in of the 45th president of the United States, a man who upset the polls and the pundits and who weathered or harnessed, might be another way of putting it, many a storm to get to where he is today. Before we dig into the sentiments of Utahns on this, I'll just mention that immediately after the program this morning, we are going to go to special live coverage of the inauguration, so stay tuned for that here on KCPW. Dan Harry, government editor with the Salt Lake Tribune. The Trib featured profiles of Utahns who are headed to D.C. either for the inauguration or for the Women's March on Washington, and at least in one case to both events. Can you give us a glimpse into who these Utahns are and their reasons for going to Washington for this event?
Yeah, so we featured six people. Three of them were going for the inauguration and support Donald Trump, and three are going to the Women's March to protest Donald Trump. And it was an interesting mix, although all three of the folks that were pro-Donald Trump happened to be just coincidentally from Utah County, which was sort of interesting. But there were, you know, various diverse characteristics. There was a Native American millennial man from Utah County who is a supporter of Donald Trump. And, you know, a lot of them just expressed hope that they're dissatisfied with the way things are. They don't like Washington, and they want something different. And Donald Trump is very different.
You know, I mentioned those two events, the inauguration, also the march on the Women's March. There's also a number of protests simultaneous to the inauguration. There are some local rallies and marches planned. Dan, do you have the details on what we can expect in Utah in terms of mass action related to the inauguration? I know we have the Women's March at Sundance, for example.
Right. There are those marches. I'm not sure I know the details locally. The big protest is going to be on Saturday, the Women's March. And, you know, you get all kinds of wild estimates about how many folks are going to attend that. But it is expected to be in the hundreds of thousands.
Hundreds of thousands.
So that will be a massive demonstration against the incoming administration and his policies that we know of so far.
And that could potentially, I don't know if dwarf is the right term, but eclipse the size of the inauguration.
Hard itself. To tell. I think what you'll see over the next couple of days is news media struggling to give estimates of crowds.
Sure.
And it's always, it's not a science. It's very difficult to do that. And I'm sure the estimates from, say, a Fox News are going to be very different from, NPR, let's say.
Sure. You know, we talked about the Utahns who are in Washington. There's a big group of them there in the form of the Mormon Tabernacle Choir. They have a sort of key billing in the inaugural program. They'll be performing between the swearing in of Mike Pence as vice president and Donald Trump as president. But the Tribune reported about a month ago now that they will be minus a member. There was one member who said that she just couldn't, in good conscience, go and do this.
Right. There was one member who actually resigned from the choir in protest over this, saying that it sent the wrong message about what the LDS Church stood for, that the choir would perform at the inauguration of Donald Trump. And indeed, you know, during the campaign, the LDS Church had come out and pointedly made note that it disagreed with then-candidate Trump's stated position on immigration and refugees. The Mormon Church is a huge supporter of immigration reform that is sort of a family-friendly policy. And you know, there is some basis for what this dissident member of the choir had said. Others said, look, this was volunteer. Not the entire choir is going. Only those who did it voluntarily would go. One interesting note is that we have a couple of reporters and a photographer in Washington covering it for the Tribune, and Tommy Burr, our D.C. correspondent, told me that the church is not allowing any interviews with choir members.
Oh, wow.
So I guess they've decided they've had enough of controversy with individual members, and they're just not going to provide any access for media.
No venue for that. Robert Gerke, newly inaugurated yourself, as I said, as a columnist.
Yeah.
We now get to hear your opinions on things. And I want to go back to, you know, we talked about the Women's March potentially being larger than the size of the inauguration. We don't know that for certain. At the same time, Donald Trump is entering the White House with the lowest approval rating of any president since they started taking approval rating polls, which was back in the late 1930s. This rating is according to a Wall Street Journal NBC News poll that has him at a very low, historically low level. What do those two things say? You know, potentially larger protest than the inauguration, low approval ratings say about where we are as a country?
Well, I on some level, it's not too surprising. This was a pretty divisive campaign, and it was, he was never very popular. He lost the popular vote, obviously, and he's had almost no honeymoon. Usually, a president gets a little bit of a grace period from both Congress and from the public, and Trump hasn't enjoyed that. It was maybe it's because he's been married so many times already, but he's coming in he's already taken some shrapnel, I think, on the issues of like the Russia hacking and his sort of strange reaction to that, his doubting the intelligence agencies and so forth. And he seems to relish picking these fights that haven't served him very well, you know, and so I'm not too surprised that his approval rating is low, and that there are protests. Obviously, there was a large portion of the population that didn't support him and didn't vote for him, and so they're going to be heard. I think, you know, obviously when you have the protesters and the supporters coming together in D.C., it's going to be a mess there. Gridlock and whatnot, but I guess the real question that we have to kind of wait and see is how this affects Trump when it comes to implementing his policies and his agenda. We've seen some of his cabinet nominees having some tough times in hearings. Rex Tillerson got grilled pretty good. Betsy DeVos was grilled pretty good the other day to be his education secretary.
Right.
And so, you know, does this hamper him when it comes to implementing policy, I think, is going to be the practical question. And I don't know that we know that yet. Some of the things that he wanted to do right out of the gate, he's just going to do through executive orders, you know, repealing some of the Obama executive orders and so forth. And he said he's going to start doing those on Monday morning and signing them all week long. So that won't matter as much. But when it comes to working with Congress, he's going to need to sort of do some rehabilitation on his image and maybe move to the center somewhat to try to gain some public support.
Public support, but not necessarily. He doesn't necessarily need to move all that much to affect policies within the Congress, because he's got a strong Congress behind him. I mean, a Republican Congress.
He's got a Republican Congress behind him, but there's also some Republicans who've questioned his agenda. And you know, when they tee up things right out of the gate, like Obamacare, repealing Obamacare. And you have Republicans already who are sort of defecting, so they want a replacement before they do the repeal. Some of them do, senators like Rand Paul. It could be problematic for him to start, you know, moving items through Congress unless he's able to keep that coalition together.
Okay. Well, I think, guys, we're going to leave the inauguration just there for a moment and give people a break in the conversation and coverage, though we will come back to it in a little bit. But we've only got reporter Matt Piper here for a little bit. And Matt, I want to turn to you now, because you have been covering the Salt Lake City beat. And last week we talked about the price tag of one of the planned shelter sites for a new homeless resource center. The purchase price for the property of the new shelter in Sugar House was $7 million. And now the city says that it will release a report about that purchase. Tell us what we might learn from that report and what else we have learned about this process since last week.
I don't know what to expect from the report, but I guess I know what we don't know, which is at what point did this property become available, and you know, why was the deal made so close to the actual announcement? It was the day before the announcement, while Mayor Biskupski was out of town attending to her ailing father. Her chief of staff, Patrick Leary, was acting as mayor, and he signed this deal. And she since said that she didn't even know that it was for $7 million, that it was a $7 million purchase, that she trusted her real estate team to make that deal. So, I mean, that begs the question, how did that happen? Why was it so late in the process that this price tag became known, and how could you sign off on it without the mayor knowing about it?
What kind of negotiations occurred as well? Sugar House residents remain upset, and you said that this report is coming, but not necessarily an announcement about a change in location for the shelter, as far as we know, right? This is still, ostensibly, as far as we know, the city's plan is to build this shelter in Sugar House.
Yeah, opponents have very much latched on to the $7 million figure. You know, County Mayor Ben McAdams has said that he thought these sites would cost about $1 to $2 million to purchase. And so, you know, you look at that versus $7 million, or you look at the assessed value, which doesn't take into account the ability to capitalize off of a property. And this place was pulling in about $30,000 a month from its tenants. But you look at that, which was something like $2.8 million, and compare that to $7 million. And there are a number of, I've heard from a number of people that they are suspicious of you know, they think that somebody is benefiting untowardly from this deal. And, you know, there's no evidence of that I'm aware of at this point. You know, what the city has said, that to find something that's suitable for families in an area like this, that your options are few and this is about what you pay. That's actually been sort of backed up by an area realtor that we talked to, who said that there are not many things like many properties like this, and developers are very interested in them. But people are always going to wonder, and especially if your house happens to be a block away from this, this is an opportunity for you maybe to take advantage of the bad press.
A couple of city council members, as we mentioned this last week, have also kind of come out against this site. One of them wants to see a new location. The other one says maybe we can just scrap the fourth site and have three locations for the new homeless resource centers. Is that right?
Yeah. So Lisa Adams, whose district includes this site at 653 Simpson, says maybe we could get by with three. She's since recognized, I think, that nobody else on the council favors that plan. And in particular, the other sort of vocal opponent of 653 East Simpson, Erin Mendenhall, whose district boundary is a couple blocks away, she has said that she fears if they get rid of that site, then the site that she's longed for, a single women's site, will be scrapped, and those women who maybe are particularly prone population will be lumped in with another potentially more dangerous population.
You know, a couple of items on this were discussed at the city council meeting, and apparently, this is one note from your article, apparently the city bought out a lawsuit as part of this purchase, this site purchase in Sugar House. Tell us about that.
So when they installed the S-line on the northern boundary of this property, they made a couple promises, or allegedly that UTA made a couple promises to the property owners about some concrete barriers and some electrical infrastructure that the property owners said they did not fulfill. And so they had sought a minimum of $300,000 in a lawsuit against UTA. The city agreed just to pay the property owners $300,000 and promises now to just resolve that lawsuit with UTA.
Okay. When might we expect this report on this site purchase?
It was promised by David Litvak, the deputy chief of staff, to Lisa Adams at this Tuesday's council meeting by Friday. So today is when it's certainly expected by Lisa and hoped for by myself as well.
Okay. Matt, I know we've only got you for a little while longer, but before we go to a break and let you go, you wrote about the golf course that is out by the airport, the Wing Point course. It's something that the mayor wants to see reopened. Mayor Jackie Biskupski wants to see reopened, but the lease terms have to be right. Explain this to us.
Yeah, so the golf course at out by the airport, it's kind of a unique looking thing. If you golf around here, you know that there are not many links style golf courses in Utah. And this was built on wetlands that don't really have any kind of aeronautical use. And 25 years ago or so, maybe coming up on 30 years ago, the Department of Airports and the city got together and said, you know, let's have a golf course here. We'll lease it. The Department of Airports, it gets kind of confusing here, but it was leased to the city by the Department of Airports for $1 a year for 99 years. But the FAA has come in retroactively and said that deal doesn't meet with their guidelines, which demands that airports that receive federal funding only are able to lease their property at fair market value.
Okay.
And fair market value for this land is something in the neighborhood of $150,000 to $200,000 per year, which at which point it doesn't pencil for Salt Lake City. And it may not have anyway. It lost money in four of its final 6 years in operation. But then making things worse, the FAA also says that this land needs to be rezoned to aeronautical or aerospace. I can't remember the exact term. That will increase the value more than tenfold, bizarrely, given that it doesn't actually have any aeronautical use. It's expected to then be worth something in the neighborhood of $2.4 million per year, at which point it doesn't come anywhere close to penciling for Salt Lake City.
It doesn't sound like it bodes well for that golf course. The city council also doesn't seem all that eager to keep pursuing this. They did kind of give a stay of execution and say, okay, we'll give you more time to try and negotiate perhaps another great lease deal. But it sounds like from what you're saying, the FAA isn't going to allow that.
Well, I guess that's unknown. What the city council did was they put in a bare minimum $60,000 to keep the tees and greens. The greens actually have quite a bit of value. To keep them alive while the city tried to broker another negotiation with the FAA. And what the city council said was they learned that Mayor Biskupski sent the FAA a letter in late November and has not heard back. And the city council said, well, that's not the kind of progress we were looking for on this front. We gave you this money early in the year, and, you know, it took you till late November to send out this letter.
And the FAA says anything?
FAA says it's preparing a response.
Okay. Yeah, Dan.
I also think the golfers who supported the Mayor Biskupski and her campaign are quite disappointed that, you know, she made a kind of a big campaign promise that she'd fight to keep Wing Point or reopen Wing Point. And as it turns out from this meeting that Matt attended the other night, it looks like the only thing the administration has actually done is kept the greens alive, but also written a letter in November, months after the mayor took office, to the FAA. And I got to think those supporters of hers in the campaign are disappointed by that.
They definitely are. We've heard from several of them. And the issue then, it becomes, again, we talked about this earlier this month when we were talking about the homeless issue, but it's another example of the administration, again, getting behind the curve and not being able to catch up. I mean, they've, you know, 11 months to write a letter, and then you've got an administration changing hands that's going to disrupt the operations of the FAA. And, you know, we're going to certainly not going to have any answers on this probably in spring when the golf course would reopen. And, you know, it's, again, the administration kind of not being on top of its game. And in part of it probably stems from the fact that they, you know, the purge, they've never really recovered from the purge of the Becker officials when Biskupski took office.
And if I could just put a promotional note in here, we have a poll that's just back.
Sure.
We looked at the favorability of Mayor Biskupski. We looked at the favorability of the homeless plan in general, and also what people think about the public engagement process during it. I'm not going to tell you the results. You will have to read Matt Piper's story this weekend.
Okay. All right. No snapshot of the results. Matt Piper, just finally before you go, trying to squeeze in all your coverage at once, you wrote about a green light or maybe a sort of go-ahead for a development right next to Salt Lake City's historic Trolley Square. This is something that Trolley Square's owner, Khosrow Semnani, wants to build, and he's apparently been negotiating with the city. An agreement has been reached or sort of movement forward, I guess?
Yeah, this would be more than 3 acres development with retail and residential across the street, across the sky bridge from the Trolley Square shopping mall. And it has been a year in the making. There has been a botched public input session. There's been they've talked about entering into a development agreement, which was sort of a unique thing because it was actually pitched by the developer in this case because of some complicated zoning stuff. It's this whole complicated mess. And the long story short, they are one step further along, and now the Historic Landmark Commission will ultimately seal it will ultimately decide its fate. The city council voted to approve the rezone, though, that was first sought a year ago.
Okay, so the Historic Landmarks Commission will need to sign off on the plans. Am I remembering correctly that these are kind of, this is sort of a development with unusual structures, turrets, towers, kind of a historic-looking building?
Yeah, so it's modeled after a historic building. It is much taller than what is currently there, and that has some local residents wondering about the effect that it's going to have on a historic district of Salt Lake City.
Okay, Matt Piper, we need to let you go, and thanks very much for joining us on the show today. We also need to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll actually return to the inauguration of Donald Trump. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio and joined for the remainder of the hour by Salt Lake Tribune government editor Dan Harry, reporter Jennifer Penrod, and Jennifer Dobner. Jennifer Dobner, thanks for being here, and columnist Robert Gerke as well. Listeners, join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK, 801-355-8255. Let's return to the incoming administration. Jennifer Dobner, you reported on sources telling Politico that Donald Trump could conceivably pick Utah Attorney General Sean Reyes to lead the Federal Trade Commission. Has that rumor fizzled or is it still going strong?
I don't know if I can answer the question. It was a hot rumor on Wednesday. We haven't really heard anything since then. So Politico reported that they had multiple sources telling them that he may be, on the list of people being considered to head the FTC. When I spoke to his political consultant and campaign manager, he said, look, we haven't applied for that. He hasn't applied for that job. He hasn't submitted a resume for that job, nor has he been contacted by the transition team for that job. So they were scrambling, it seems like, in the moment to figure out if there was some there. And we really haven't heard anything since.
Reyes himself, though, in a radio interview, said that he wanted to stay here in Utah.
Well, he was at Trump Tower on the night of the election. He was with Mr. Trump. And the next day he was on the Rod Arquette show over on KNRS radio. And he said he was being asked by a lot of people if he was, going to leave Utah for Washington. And he was, firm in his response of absolutely not. He loves his current job, but he would serve in any capacity if there was a way for Utah to be assist the president-elect. So that, as far as I can tell at this moment, that's as far as this whole thing has gone.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll know soon enough. After the inauguration, which is now just minutes away or conceivably happening soon. And I'll just remind listeners that we will have some special live coverage of that event immediately after this program. Other news related to the incoming administration, Dan Harry, Representative Jason Chaffetz, head of the House Oversight Committee, says this week that he won't launch an investigation or what he called a fishing expedition into Donald Trump's business dealings, including potential ties with Russia. And this is something that people had been a lot of people have been trying to urge him to do.
Yeah, what a change of roles for Jason Chaffetz we've seen. We saw him go from being sort of the attack dog against the administration to now it looks like kind of the guard dog. He is he's fiercely resisted a lot of people asking that he investigate potential conflicts. And some of these folks are friendly to the incoming administration, actually saying, you know, why don't you investigate this and let's make sure we get everything out on the table so there are no surprises later on. But that that has not happened. A poll of Utah voters showed that by almost a two-thirds margin, Utahns want those investigations. And, of course, Utah is a state that a plurality voted for Donald Trump. So it looks like there's going to be some very different rules of the Oversight Committee as we go forward.
Will that polling or, you know, the public sentiment from his home state of Utah have an effect on whether he you know, might actually change his tune and begin an investigation of this sort, Robert Gerke?
No, I doubt it. I mean, it's Jason Chaffetz is not in any danger of losing an election, and I think the public opinion on this one is going to take a back seat to his party loyalty, which appears to be his the driving force in his decision making right now. I mean, to call it, I mean, he says he's not going to go on a fishing expedition, but I mean, he's got a whale in the bathtub right now. He doesn't have to look very far to find these conflicts of interest. And not only is he not looking for the conflicts of interest in the Trump administration, he's actually protecting, he's going after not even critics, but the nonpartisan ethics office that you know, suggested that there might be conflicts of interest, and he's and I think was embarrassed fairly severely this week when he was going after the ethics office and claiming they wouldn't meet with him, and then he stood up the head of the ethics office in a meeting. I believe it was earlier or late last year.
It was December. He had said that you know, he publicly come out and said that the head of the ethics office, Walter Schaub, hadn't met with him and wouldn't meet with him. And actually, it had been Chaffetz who didn't show up.
They had a meeting arranged and Chaffetz didn't show. So, you know, you look at the tenacity he showed when he was going after the email scandal and Fast and Furious and Benghazi during the Obama administration and the IRS, and contrast that with him now going after anybody who even criticizes a president who, frankly, Chaffetz was not a big fan of during the campaign, but I think it shows that he is a partisan first and a neutral investigator second, and worries more about the way the Republican Party looks than the way that Washington operates.
Robert Gerke with the filter off as a columnist. I love it. Dan Harry, we learned also this week that there's a Republican testing the waters to challenge Chaffetz for his seat, a guy called Damian Kidd. Who is this?
Right. He's an attorney and really hasn't been involved in politics. I think he was like an assistant prosecutor in Idaho. So that story got a lot of attention, although it was, the election's 2 years away and this guy's really an unknown. So, you know, if we could see challengers surface to Chaffetz, because he has taken a beating in the press and in the public opinion this last week or two. But as Robert says, you know, if you look at the history, his reelections are by massive landslides, and he's generally facing a token opposition. I don't think that's going to change.
I mean, I would suggest that there maybe is an opening there because if you look back, the reason Jason Chaffetz is a congressman today is because he beat Chris Cannon in a primary. So there is a way, there is precedent, I guess, for somebody getting knocked out in that primary or for the Republican nomination. It seems unlikely, given that Chaffetz is established, incumbents almost always win, and this guy's fairly unknown. But there's also another option too, and that is that maybe this guy is setting himself up if Chaffetz decides he's going to run for for Senate, and then there's an open seat, and you know he's established himself as a candidate there. So I'm sure that Congressman Chaffetz is probably not shaking in his boots over this potential challenge, but it does show perhaps that there's a little bit of discontent with the way he's conducted himself in office.
Is he potentially trying to be somebody who is friendly to the president-elect and maybe seek some sort of appointment? Is it too late for that at this point?
I can't speak to that very intelligently, but I would say I don't see any sign of him wanting a spot in the administration. I think in some respects he, during the campaign, had some very critical comments of Donald Trump. He at one point, after the release of the embarrassing Access Hollywood tape, said that he could not support Trump, that he could not do so and look his daughter in the eyes. And then two or three weeks later, he changed and said he would vote for Donald Trump. And the reason that he gave was that Hillary Clinton was such a horrible prospect as president of the United States.
I think at this point, for Chaffetz to give up a seat in Congress and the chairmanship that he's got and the seniority to go, most of the big appointments are already filled or at least close to being filled, and so it probably wouldn't be much that you could dangle in front of him to jump ship.
I guess chairman of the Oversight Committee during a Republican administration is not nearly as attractive as it is of the Democratic administration. Who is he going to go after?
Well, the ethics office, I guess.
Well, guys, we're going to take another quick break here on Behind the Headlines, and when we return, we'll come back to the state of Utah and look at the trial of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and across the state on Utah Public Radio. We'll be back in 1 minute. Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Jennifer Dobner, and Robert Gerke. You can join us with your comments and questions by calling 801-355-TALK or commenting at sltrib.com. Jennifer Dobner, returning to some reporting that you did this week, we're closing in on the start of the trial of former Utah Attorney General John Swallow. Some recent developments in that trial this week. Swallow says the judge in his case is biased and should recuse herself. What's he basing that on? Or what is his lawyer? His lawyer is basing that on.
Well, they basically got, I think, four grounds for saying they think she's exhibited bias. One is that she has denied every single defense motion seeking an evidentiary hearing to root out the answers to some legal questions. She's just taken taken the state, Salt Lake County District Attorney's Office, at face value every single time and not given Swallow's people a chance to put anybody on the stand ahead of time and ask some questions to understand better, you know, what the case is going to look like. There's never been an evidentiary hearing in this case, not in 4 years or, well, 2 years since they, 2.5 years almost since they've been charged. So that's one reason. The other reason is she failed to hold a hearing to determine whether or not a cache of something like 12,000 emails that the government got when they served a search warrant on Swallow's house was actually accessed, read, and used by prosecutors and investigators. It's what we know is that it's been commingled with other case evidence, and that was inappropriate. So it's been mishandled in some way, but she's never done anything to exercise any oversight over the future handling of that or sort of figure out how they got in this messy situation. The other things are...
she arrested, or she had a witness arrested, correct?
So she signed an ex parte petition to arrest a former criminal deputy in the Utah Attorney General's office by the name of Kirk Torgensen. He's a key witness in this case. He probably was close to being charged himself at one point, but that didn't happen. But he knows a lot, and he's expected to testify for the prosecutors. He no longer lives in Utah. He was in town the first week of January before his mother's funeral, mm-hmm. And he was in conversation with the DA's office about the fact that he has a family trip planned for the window in which the trial is happening, and he needed to find a way to work this out with them. And they just decided that they didn't trust him, and so they sought his arrest.
As a flight risk, essentially. I mean, it's compelling a witness is the idea.
Yeah, and under the material witness warrant, they could have held him in jail until after the trial was over, or at least until after the point that he testified. His lawyers argued that the prosecutors skipped a step, that they really didn't do their homework, and they didn't really justify the arrest to the court, and the court should never have signed that warrant. And so that's another reason that Swallow's attorneys think that she is biased.
Will she, this is Judge Elizabeth
Ruby Mills.
Ruby Mills,
yeah.
Is she in the process of deciding that, or how is that decision made?
So how that works is if you're challenged, she could recuse herself, but she has not done that. She has turned the information over to what they call a reviewing judge to look at the materials, read the pleadings, and make a decision. In the third district, where we are in Salt Lake City, that's typically also the presiding judge, who's right now is Randall Skanke. But the courts won't say if, in fact, Skanke's the one who's going to do the review. We don't know how long it will take. We don't know if that means it will delay the trial, which is supposed to start on February 7th. So we're just a little bit up in the air about what's going to happen. Some people say doing this, I mean, this is fairly unusual to do this. Some people say it's like, you know, legal suicide to challenge a judge's fairness. But in talking to Swallow's attorney, he said he feels like it's his duty to raise those concerns. He may also be moving to preserve some sort of appellate record. And, you know, we don't know what's going to happen. In the meantime, you know, there's a hearing next week on Tuesday to determine whether or not some hearsay statements by Mark Shurtleff and other people deemed co-conspirators are going to be allowed to be introduced into the trial so the jury could hear them.
And, this is Swallow's predecessor, Mark Shurtleff.
Mark Shurtleff, yes. And who, by the way, is not on anybody's witness list, which I think is very interesting. And the jury selection process is supposed to begin next week. They're going to bring 200 people in to fill out a 100-question survey about, you know, what they know about the trial, what they've heard, if they have opinions and things like that. So on the one hand, things are moving forward. On the other hand, we have sort of a pause button, which I would be surprised if they recuse the judge, but it's just another wrench in the
delay. I mean, and could represent a delay for this for the trial.
Potentially, but
you know, you wrote also about prosecutors not wanting Davis County District Attorney Troy Rawlings to testify in this trial. Why not?
So John Swallow's attorneys want him on the stand because he's a prosecutor and he knows about this charge, pattern of unlawful activity. It's essentially a racketeering charge. It's one of the counts filed against Swallow. It was also filed against Shurtleff back in 2014 when the cases were originally brought. When those cases were split, Rawlings took Shurtleff, and he immediately amended the charges and tossed out the racketeering charge. He didn't think that there was enough evidence there to support the charge. So I think what Swallow's people want is him on the stand saying there's not enough evidence here to support this charge. Salt Lake County feels their case is different. They think, number one, he doesn't belong there because he was on the prosecution team that brought these charges, and so he has privileged information in his head that he shouldn't be allowed to share. They're also claiming that he is, although an experienced prosecutor, not an expert because he has never himself brought a racketeering charge and successfully prosecuted it. So we'll see where that goes.
Also a decision to be made by the judge, whoever
Elizabeth
that may
Ruby
be.
Mills. Yeah, okay. Yeah, same judge.
Okay, fantastic.
Yeah.
Well, I actually want to turn, we're running out of time on all of the stories that we have to cover, and I want to turn to something that Robert Gerby, you wrote this week about a fight potentially looming at the Utah State Legislature. This is a story about watershed protection and development in Big Cottonwood Canyon, efforts continually underway to change the rules regarding what can happen development-wise in the Cottonwood Canyons. Being led by maybe specific groups. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's
extremely complicated and convoluted, and it's been going on for a long time, but it boils down to this. There's a group of landowners who own land in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon, and they're frustrated with the city because the city is denying them access to water. And without the water, they're having a hard time they can't develop their property up there. And so what they're trying to do is come to the legislature and strip Salt Lake City of this authority that it's had for over 100 years to regulate the watersheds in Big and Little Cottonwood Canyon. They sort of have a co-regulation authority with Salt Lake County. And so they are, this is something that this fight with the city's been going on for years, but it's sort of reaching ahead, and they've been working with the Quality Growth Commission, which is a commission that not many people know about, but they were created years ago to administer the Leray McAllister Trust Fund, which is for land conservation. Now they're in the process of trying to put together recommendations to the legislature on whether or not Salt Lake City should continue to enjoy this jurisdiction. The city obviously is strongly opposed to it. They don't want to lose their authority to protect the watershed. Salt Lake County, Sandy City, all of sort of the municipal governments in Salt Lake County have come out in opposition to this. But the legislature is very amenable, I guess, friendly to property rights and complaints from property owners when they bring these issues to them. And so I think you will see this on some level probably surface during the legislative session. During yesterday's Quality Growth Commission meeting when they met, they did say that they don't plan on making recommendations until after the session, but I wouldn't be surprised if you still see a push directly to the legislature to address this.
Is it as simple as people wanting to develop property that is off limits because of watershed protection for the county?
I'll tell you that's what it looks like to me. I mean, these landowners insist they're concerned about conservation. It looks to me like at the very least they want to make a buck in trying to trade out this land and you know, or use the threat of development to escalate the values of their property.
Guys, I wanted to turn to some other legislative stories, including hate crimes legislation that Jennifer Doudna reported on, but we're actually really low on time, and so I think we need to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week, in which we bring up the stories that maybe didn't get enough play or just we didn't talk about today. Who's got an underplayed story of the week? Anybody?
I will go with an item that Paul Raleigh had in his column today, and that is the almost epidemic exposure of corruption and self-dealing that has been exposed in recent months from quasi-public agencies. From the most recent ones were the Unified Fire Authority and the Utah League of Cities and Towns, but there's a long list, the Utah Communications Authority, Utah Transit Authority a couple of years back. And, you know, it really, I think, says something about the governance of those entities.
I feel like you're leaving one out, and I can't remember from earlier this year.
I'm leaving several out. Yeah, I mean, sure. There's quite a few.
The 911.
The Utah Communications Authority.
Utopia, I guess.
Utopia has another one.
Right.
So okay. Some water districts.
Check it out at sltrip.com, Paul Raleigh's column on that topic. Jen Doudna, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
Well, it's in today's paper, so I don't know if it's underplayed yet, but it's Lee Davidson's really interesting story about tobacco taxes and how more than a third of the cigarettes sold in Utah or brought into Utah or smoked in Utah are actually contraband because people buy them elsewhere and bring them here because the taxes are too high. Who knew?
Wow. So a story about contraband tobacco. Who knew? I had no idea either.
At the prison, sure, there's contraband tobacco, but not at the coffee shop down the block.
The question is it counterfeit as well? Is it not real? Is it sawdust or something? Robert Gerke, your underplayed story of the week.
I would just, during his confirmation hearing last week, Interior nominee Ryan Zinke was asked whether the president could dissolve Bears Ears National Monument. Mm-hmm. And he was sort of inconclusive on it, but it does seem like something that's teed up. He's obviously getting pressure from the Utah delegation who wants to see this thing removed. And, you know, there's
obviously disputes over whether or not he can do that. But it is something that's on his radar, obviously, because he was asked about it during his confirmation hearing. And it will be something to watch during the early stages, I would imagine, of the Trump administration.
At some point, didn't he say he plans on visiting Utah to kind of check? And maybe you didn't see this, but to come and check out the grumblings on the ground.
Yeah, I think that's likely to happen. And I think you'll likely see him out here probably, again, early in the administration, sometime in these first few months.
Okay. For my underplayed story of the week, I will go with one that appeared in the Tribune that looked at research being done at Huntsman Cancer Institute. Elephants apparently don't get cancer nearly as frequently as humans, and it's because they have this tumor-suppressing protein in their genetic makeup in a lot larger numbers than we have. Reporter Alex Stuckey wrote about this and research being done on it. A couple of videos from the lab working on it. And it's pretty fascinating. You can check it out at the Tribune's website, sltrib.com. Salt Lake Tribune news editor Dan Harry, reporters Jennifer Dobner, and columnist Robert Gerke, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Roger.
Thank you.
And many thanks as well to Matt Piper, who joined us earlier. We will wrap up this week with Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby. Today, Kirby talks about Utah drivers and pedestrians. There was a study, Robert, about Utah drivers and how awful they are. Apparently the number one worst drivers in the nation.
It is official now. We all had our arguments in the past about it just being different from where you came from or just because you were having a bad day or whatever. We now have scientific evidence that we're the worst drivers in the United States.
Before we go too far into this, I always feel like everybody, whatever state they're from, they all think they come from the state with the worst drivers. I mean, people in Massachusetts say, oh, we've got the worst drivers. And, you know, my perception has been, yeah, Utah has the worst drivers, but I'm obviously part of the problem because I, you know, grew up
here. Yeah, I drive in Utah.
Therefore, I'm blind to it. But this got you thinking a little bit about pedestrians and how is there anything tracking how bad pedestrians are in any given community?
I don't know, but just from personal observation, I say there's just as many rude pedestrians. The only difference being is that if you're not in a car, it's going to hurt a lot more if you get hit.
A lot of jaywalkers, you say, people cutting in front of trains.
Well, I've noticed that I only started coming into the office on a regular basis in the last couple of months. And so I've had to learn how to be a pedestrian because out where I live, you can cross a street at your leisure. That's not true downtown. Not only could you get hit, there are people who actually want to hit you. I firmly believe that. They've driven all the way down from Ogden to get to work, and they're no mood to put up with pedestrians.
I thought you were going to say they'd driven all the way down from Ogden to hit pedestrians.
No.
And that's, you know, that's part of it, the sense of rage, you know, road rage, these split-second switches that happen within us when we're driving around in these vehicles that can do serious damage. Sometimes it's hard to remind yourself that the road rage isn't worth it.
No, yeah, right. I mean, it isn't worth it. You can be as frustrated as you want, but you're not really going to change it by throwing a fit. And it's you see it all the time on the streets where people just come uncorked over something that really wouldn't matter on a different day. And the monster's out, and suddenly you can't control him.
Do you find that happening to you ever?
No, I usually just curse at the rearview mirror.
That's good of you.
I mean, if I'm alone.
Yeah. You wrote that you yourself had been hit by traffic on four separate occasions in your life. You don't go into the details, but once when you were a teenager and running from the cops.
Yep.
Twice when you were a cop yourself.
Yep.
And once as an LDS missionary.
Yep.
And the first and the last of those, when you were a teenager running from the cops and as an LDS missionary, were both your fault, you said.
Yes, it is true. Mm. They're both my fault. Actually, if you want to really think about it, they were all my fault, you know, standing out trying to direct traffic on an icy road that's a slope.
As a policeman. Yeah.
Yeah, I had a lady come down the hill, down a viaduct, sideways, staring straight at me as her car just moving along about 30 miles an hour hit me and knocked me down the viaduct on my back, spinning around like a turtle. What I remembered most was her eyes, you know, and how I could hear her screaming inside her car.
And nowhere to run to, I imagine. Especially
no, I mean, I wanted to stay on my feet because I knew if I tried to run, I'd fall down and she'd run over me.
Yeah. Well, be safe out there.
Be safe out there. Take out your earphones, you know, pay attention to what's going on, and get home safe.
A public service announcement there from Salt Lake Tribune columnist Robert Kirby to end this edition of Behind the Headlines. You can find all of his opinions, the full Kirby archives, at sltrib.com. Coming up next on KCPW, stay tuned for special live coverage of the inauguration, courtesy of the BBC World Service. We'll have actually some analysis and international reaction and analysis as well from the BBC. So stay tuned for that here on KCPW. And I'll quickly mention that you can find us on Facebook at KCPW-FM and at Twitter. We are at KCPW. Also, the Utah State Legislative Session begins next week. We will have coverage of that as well as updates. Stay tuned for all of that and much more to come on KCPW. That does it for the show today. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, to Tom Williams and Connor Rivers at Utah Public Radio and to the Salt Lake Tribune's Emily Means. And listeners, we always appreciate your contributions. We are a public radio station, and your contributions allow us to be here. You can make a donation at any time at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks once again for listening, and we will see you here once again at the same time next week.